From WXXI News, it's 1370 Connection. I'm Bob Smith, and every once in a while, well, you got to make time for some guilty pleasures. And with me now to talk about the film fan's guilty pleasure, film noir, around the table are Shannon Clute and Richard Edwards, film scholars and folks who advise a lot of the cable channels that provide them on a regular basis, not to mention Jared Case, film historian on the staff of the Eastman House here in Rochester, who you saw talking film history recently with Robert Osborne of the Turner Classic Movies channel during Eastman House tribute programming. In answer to there, of course, playing a vital role in film preservation. Now, they're all going to be presenting an underrated 1947 Humphrey Bogart classic, Dead Reckoning, tonight at 8 at the Dryden Theater on the Eastman campus. And they're here in connection with that and in connection with the whole month of film noir that the Dryden is showing, celebrating that particular genre. And I welcome you all to the show today, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Bob.
I want to talk first about what film noir is. In a way, maybe we kind of know it when we see it, but is there a good definition of this genre that's been going on for over 80 years and maybe even dates back to the silence?
That's a great question, and it's funny. It's very often thought of as a visual style, primarily, and one of the things that Rich and I have really discussed in our own work on noir is that it's also a philosophical stance, and so people will often debate, is noir a style that's just visually recognizable, or is it a genre where it's certain types of stories? I fall more on the genre side of things. I think that while, yes, some of these are crime stories and some are more melodramas, what they have in common is a particular form, I guess for lack of a better term, it's kind of a brutal existentialism. If you make a mistake once, fate is going to track you down. And it's different, I think, from Westerns or war pictures in that it's often fate that tracks you down more than an act of human agency. So it's not that somebody gets you back, like in a Western. It's more like you're going to pay. And I think that's a key distinction.
Right. In a way, I know a lot of people think about it as either pre-World War II or the time between about 1930 and 1960, I know some people say. I think the best film noir director out there is Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of, you know, we're in a new period, especially the last decade or so, where we have really seen the reemergence of the noir aesthetic, because noir films, with their dark thematics and with their style that comes out of the crime thriller genre, really fit well when cultures are in crisis, as America was after 9/11. And so You really see noir films happening at two distinct points in American history, both in the post-war period after World War II and in our contemporary moment. And in addition to people like Tarantino, I think, you know, auteurs like Christopher Nolan and Rian Johnson are doing some of our best noir work in decades.
And it's not all in black and white either.
No.
I mean, let's face it, Kill Bill is in vivid color.
Right. Right.
Mostly
sure.
Red, but it's color.
Yeah, no mistake in that. And you know, Rich makes a good point. And to back up, it's not just post-war. It's during wartime periods as well. You know, the classic period of noir, a lot of people will say, is 41 to 58. It's the Maltese Falcon to Touch of Evil. And yet, certainly, you can say that it extends back into some of the gritty realism of the 30s. You know, a film like I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. And it extends into the 60s. And then well beyond. I mean, Chinatown is one of the great... A lot of times people will talk about neo-noir films, those that occurred sort of just after the classical period but are very much noir films, or Rian Johnson's Brick, as Rich pointed out, or Nolan's Memento. These are great films.
Or maybe now playing Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to a certain extent.
Yeah, and what becomes interesting about a film and a book series like Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy is you start to recognize that this very American film style, this film style that comes out of the Hollywood studio system, that really is an emergence of a style that it has these dark thematics occurring during World War II and just after, are now increasingly a global style. And mm-hmm. so you are now thinking about things like Girl with the Dragon Tattoo as maybe indicative of what we would call Nordic noir, which might have been a misnomer or not a misnomer, but it would have been a phrase that wouldn't really have had any purchase, say, 50 years ago. But now noir is increasingly a global phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Even though the actress playing Nordic noir is from North Jersey
right.
and a descendant of the family that owns the New York Giants.
Right. Yeah. Go figure.
I mean, it doesn't get more American than Rudy Mara does, really, yeah. when you come right down to it.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we're back to where it started.
Yeah, what goes around comes around. That's certainly a theme of noir, too. But it is interesting, as Rich pointed out, it's a distinctly American style, and yet what a strange distinctly American style, because it was really the result of writers out of the American pulps who had honed their craft in the 20s and 30s getting to Hollywood, combined with this influx of mostly Eastern European immigrant directors, so people like Preminger, Siadmak, and strangely this German expressionistic film visual style collides with a hard-boiled American writing style, and that's the birth of noir. So you get something that's at least half European, and yet it is the most distinctly American film style in many ways, or at least I would argue that it is.
Right, but what becomes fun with that, Shannon, is of course the name film noir was designated by French film critics.
Right.
So this most American style has a French name.
Sure.
And they started it here in the United States. Maybe it's a child of the Depression.
Absolutely. I mean, hard-boiled writing in particular was. I mean, the influx of these pulp publications in the 20s and 30s were partly an outgrowth of the Depression. This was good, cheap reading that was, it was easy entertainment. It was, it was escapist, and it was cheap, and it was everywhere. And that really is a place where a lot of the best writers started to hone their craft in a new style that was sort of world-weary, that was more gritty, that was more reflective of the times. So, yeah.
Yeah, and what's really fun about that is also the idea that as we're really talking about film noir, we really recognize in the American arts there was a counter-movement around certain novelists and certain writers, especially around a series of pulp magazines, such as mm-hmm. The Black Mask, where you really get really talented writers such as Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler publishing for a pulp audience that precedes the film noir phenomenon by about a decade. And then when you start to read these stories even today, the original stories for, say, The Maltese Falcon or The Big Sleep or The Glass Key are much more hard-boiled in their literary incarnations, and you start to see the impacts of censorship and how the studio system had to take these dynamic stories and kind of, soften their edges a bit. And so there's that great moment with noir where it becomes a style expressing things that couldn't be said quite as explicitly on screen in the 1940s as we can today.
You can show it, you can hint it, you can't say it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Pre-code, you could say it.
Right.
Kinda.
Everything's been coded. I mean, it's, film has always been a coded style for the most part, or a coded medium. But yeah, I think that's a good point.
I mean, the last line of Five Star Final, Edward G. Robinson said it, but the last word of the last line had to be covered up by the sound effect of glass breaking mm-hmm. as he was throwing the phone through the door.
Yeah. Well, and it's always very interesting, like if there are listeners to this program who aren't as familiar with the era of censorship in the 1940s and 50s, these film scripts actually had to be pre-approved by an office called the Breen Office, where they actually would redline objectionable material. And the studio had to, in order to get the seal of approval to show a film in a theater, comply with fairly rigorous censorship laws that really held forth all the way through the 1960s. And so frequently these films really did do an incredible tightwalk act with being able to wink at the audience and suggest mm-hmm. things, while at the same time they really couldn't get particularly explicit. But in that moment, the creative constraint of censorship actually, I think, has really helped the style be incredible. I think films like Gilda and The Postman Always Rings Twice are so much better because the sexuality has to be, off screen, and you can only really hint at some of it.
Okay, so is a film like that really better than a pretty frank film like, take an example, the pairing of William Hurt and Kathleen Turner in Body Heat in 1981, which is pretty out there.
Yes. I'm not going to hesitate. I'm going to say yes.
You really think so?
And here's why. I think that part of what is so distinctly noir is the fact that there was censorship. And so these films developed a whole series of codes of visual motifs, as they say, these sort of repeated structuring elements in the films, where this motif stood in for what couldn't be shown. So you'll often see in films noir a fluttering of a curtain with open windows that stands in for the two having, you know, had their relations. You'll see the motif of the staircase that shows the ascending or descending fate of a character in ways that you couldn't just show, say, that character's brutal murder, but you can suggest that something bad is about to happen because they're coming down the stairs. You get a whole series of codes that actually help to define what noir itself is. And so what happens, in my opinion, is with a lot of neo-noir films, when you stop having this censorship, you lose touch with those motifs that actually help to define it as a noir. So Body Heat can have some of the trappings of noir, but it isn't as essentially noir because it isn't structured around these motifs that are themselves the outgrowths of censorship.
But you had to really film it that way in 1981. You had to film Basic Instinct the way you did in 1992, or else it wouldn't have worked for us today.
Well, of course, and that's part of the greatness of cinema history, is that it is an evolutionary art form. It's never been static, and it has always updated itself to be in keeping with the times. And so that's why a lot of scholars came up with this designation neo-noir to describe films that came after Chinatown, because we really wanted to draw a distinction between what Shannon was just talking about, that there was a point at which you have this phenomenon, to start with your opening question, called noir, that we couldn't quite define. We know it when we see it, but we can't really say definitively that this film's a noir and this film's not a noir. But we do know some of the things that films conventionally understood as noir share in common: a historical moment, a certain style, a certain type of literary pedigree. And then when we get into the 80s with films like Body Heat and Basic Instinct, you can see how this style can work, as we have different views of culture, especially around some of the figures of the femme fatale.
So are you saying that 1974 and Chinatown is the dividing line between the traditional and the new franker way of doing it?
I would have drawn it differently.
Is Jack Nicholson the last true noir hero then? Anti-hero?
You know, that's a good question, and I might have drawn the distinction a little differently. I think Chinatown is in many ways one of the defining neo-noir films. It's one of the first color noir films produced after the classic period that has a throwback subject matter and visual style. So it's a defining film in that way. And of course, it was so well directed by Polanski. He really did things like mute the color palette to take these incredibly bright Southern California colors that are so distinctive and make them look and feel more like a film noir. He sort of cut everything with gray. So it set a look that has been defining for neo-noir films since then, especially neo-noir films in color. But in some ways, you can just argue that anything post-58, that is post-Touch of Evil, is a neo-noir film. But to go back to another point about why these things work and why they don't, to me, when you gave the example of Body Heat, I didn't hesitate to say the films were better in the classical period. But that's not to say there aren't neo-noir films that are every bit as ingenious as films of the classical era. I would point to a film like Brick, which I absolutely love. Brick is this brilliant borrowing of the hard-boiled style to a modern setting. And to me, it's the hard-boiled guts of a film noir that are as or almost more important than the visual style. So what Rian Johnson does with Brick is brilliant. He takes hard-boiled writing that is straight up, it sounds like Dashiell Hammett, and or Dashiell Hammett, apparently I've been told, is supposed to be, who says that? And he takes that hard-boiled writing of the 30s, and he sets it in a modern L.A. high school. And his point is, well, why is that absurd? Because the lingo of teenagers is about marking a distinction between us, the criminal element, and them, the straight-laced folks. And that's exactly what the criminal slang of the 30s was. And so he, without any real sense of irony for much of the running time of the film, straight up 1930s dialogue set in a modern high school. The moment of irony that erupts is when Richard Roundtree, as the high school principal, sort of reads the kid the riot act. And it's just brilliant because you realize at that moment how conscious he is of what he's doing. But it's, you know, there are these great films that are happening in the noir style still. Sure.
By the way, if you've got a favorite noir film, tell us what it is. Mm-hmm. Call in 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I'm Bob Smith. Lines are open right now. We're talking film on 1370 Connection. We're talking it with Shannon Clute and Richard Edwards. We're going to be presenting the 47 Humphrey Bogart classic Dead Reckoning tonight at Dryden Theater as part of a month-long festival of noir that the Eastman Theater, the Eastman House, is portraying right now. And we're also joined right here by Jared Case of the Eastman staff. You recently saw Talking Film History with Robert Osborne on TV. And we're talking film. We're talking film of the past that's informing film of the present right up to today, right up to the recent Oscar nominees. Yeah. Dial 263-WXXI and talk to us about it.
And one of the things that, you know, is very important around this whole conversation is one of the reasons why we can still talk about film noir in the classic period is because we have institutions like the George Eastman House that are actually preserving these films so that we can still appreciate and study them. And the work that Jared does is every bit as important as the kind of critical work that Shannon and I do, because without the films themselves, we have nothing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although it is kind of a niche product still, isn't it? When you come right down to it. I mean, that you may not have as much demand for it on the classic channels that show films of the past as you do for some others, like the musicals or comedies or something like that, or shoot 'em up westerns or anything. This is kind of maybe an acquired taste.
Noir? Well, you know, working, because I work for Turner Classic Movies, I'm not going to say that any classic film genre is niche, because, you know, I won't admit that. I think it's all mainstream and important. But you're right, in a sense. I do think that noir is an acquired taste. It was a style that did draw box office at the time, but certainly not like some of the musicals of the era did. It's relatively rare to have a real A picture with a big budget that was a film noir of the era, although the ones that we remember for the most part often were films like Double Indemnity or The Killers. But a lot of good films noir and a lot of what constituted the noir style, these were B films that were, you know, second billing, films like Detour or The Hitchhiker. And yet they're as every bit as important to our understanding of film history as the big A pictures. And I second what Rich said about, you know, the work of the Eastman House and how important it is to have these films preserved.
Yeah. And just to jump in on that, Shannon, the other part that I always like to point out is not only sometimes were these films, you know, maybe didn't have the budgets and the cast of other films, but it was very rare for a director not to do some of their best work in the noir aesthetic. And I just start to think about how many directors, when they were doing noir scripts or noir films, really did their masterworks in this genre. So you can talk about a director like Billy Wilder and how Double Indemnity is so brilliant.
Or Sunset Boulevard.
You have Alfred Hitchcock in films like Notorious and Shadow of a Doubt. You have Orson Welles, who really, if you start to think about it, already Citizen Kane's a kind of noir film, but it's really Lady from Shanghai, The Stranger, and Touch of Evil. And so you have this type of storytelling that when you get a talented crew together in Hollywood, we're doing their best work.
Is it a challenge? And Jared, you've been helping out with this. Is it a challenge to even find them all? Are some of these films, especially the ones before 1950, hard to find or maybe even lost?
Well, there's some that certainly haven't seen the light of day, and I think a lot of that has to do with who owns the rights or who's trying to make them available to people. We do have some Monogram and Allied Artist films in our Nitrate collection that simply haven't been copied, and we've been trying to rectify that situation. There's a film called Fall Guy, which we preserved last year. It's a 1947 film with Robert Armstrong and Elijah Cook. And there's another one called Wife Wanted, which I think is going to be done soon, which is a Kay Francis film that simply hasn't seen the light of day.
How come? Is it just because they're not being shown on TV, because we don't have television stations doing the late movies anymore, or what?
A lot of it has to do with whether or not it's been preserved on film. And that's what we're doing at the George Eastman House, is trying to not only preserve the content of the film, but also the artifact itself, preserving not only what can be seen, but how it can be seen, preserving the experience of going to a theater and seeing it on 35 millimeter film with a group of people, a large screen in front of you, surrounded by the sound in the way that people saw it over half a century ago.
Is that different from seeing it on a small screen on television or even a home theater?
Marshall McLuhan was famous for saying the medium is the message, and I think that the impact of a film on a three-inch telephone screen is going to be vastly different than seeing it on a big screen.
Well, I'm going to say nothing should be viewed on a 3-inch telephone screen. Yeah. That you're going to miss everything that way. Don't bother.
Right. And just real quick, I mean, films are also meant to be watched in community. When you watch a great film noir with 300 of your friends and neighbors, nothing's better.
I agree.
263 WXXI, 263-9994. Got Barbara on the line. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Yes. Might you have any comment about a film? I believe it was called The Elevator, and it was a Louis Malle film.
Mm-hmm. French cinema. That's Shannon.
Yeah.
Elevator to the Gallows?
Yes.
It may have been. I just remember the word elevator was in it. It was a Louis Malle film. It's black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Shown at the Dryden about 5 years ago, and I'd seen it when it first came out.
Yeah, it was visually a very striking film. Mid-century French films noir are an interesting case because, as Rich sort of hinted at earlier, the French gave the designation film noir to these American crime pictures. And that in itself is an interesting history. What happened is, of course, there was an embargo on films, American films coming into France during the war because this was occupied France. And when that embargo is lifted at the end of the war, there's a sudden influx of these very thematically and visually dark crime pictures. And the French were stunned because they'd never seen anything like this coming out of Hollywood. And the best point of reference was hard-boiled literature, to go back to the literary roots. And the French had been publishing the American hard-boiled authors for years under a series from the French publishing house of Gallimard called Série Noire, the Black Series. And these had black covers, and they were dark crime stories. So the French give this term to American film noir, but it's a good decade later that French, a new crop of young French directors, Malle among them, but others, Godard as well, Melville, start to create their take on American film noir, and you get these really interesting pictures. They're dark, they're gritty like American films noir. They're often more self-conscious, as is true of French literature. And in the case of Elevator to the Gallows, if I'm remembering correctly, that was also the incredible Miles Davis soundtrack. Is that right? So it was actually played live. The French were great connoisseurs of jazz as well. They brought Miles Davis into the studio, and he just watched the film and played the soundtrack, and it remains this iconic soundtrack.
Did he riff it? Did he improvise it as he was going along and reacting to the movie?
Yes. Largely so. I mean, I think he may have seen it once before deciding to go ahead. I don't know that he was doing it first viewing, but it was not something that he spent a lot of time preparing.
No, he just improvised it based on what he saw and what his impression was.
Yeah.
They almost never do that in American film.
No.
That's the only time I've ever heard it done anywhere. That's inventive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, do thank you very much for calling in. That was, I guess, according to my little cheat sheet here, 1958.
Mm-hmm. 58.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Right. It was right on the dawn of the French New Wave. And as Shannon mentioned, if people want to check out some really great French films noir, the work of Melville, especially a film called Bob the Gambler.
Or Bob the Samurai.
Flambeur, Les Samurai, and then also Godard and his famous film Breathless are really French versions of an American phenomenon, and they're just fascinating in their own right.
263-WXXI is the number 1370 connection of the program. Share your favorite film noir with us. As a matter of fact, Eastman House is doing the same thing, a month-long festival of the noir. We're right in the middle of it right now at the Dryden Theater tonight. Dead Reckoning, the Humphrey Bogart 1947 film showing. Shannon Clute and Richard Edwards are here in town to present it to us, along with Jared Case of the Eastman House, and they're here right now in advance of the showing this evening and talking with us in 1370 Connection. I'm Bob Smith. We're back in a minute on WXXI AM 1370. Yeah. 70 Connection continuing in WXXI. I'm Bob Smith. Going to the movies right now. One of the guilty pleasures of film fans is the film noir. We've got experts on that. Shannon Clute and Richard Edwards, along with Dryden Theater and the Eastman House's Jared Case, film historian at the Eastman staff. Together, they are putting together the presentation this evening of the 47 Humphrey Bogart classic Dead Reckoning at the Dryden Theater as part of a month-long festival at the Eastman House of film noir from the 30s through the 50s, although film noir itself is even alive and well today. 263-WXXI, we got Keith on the line. Keith, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Certain movies have always allowed some actors to become true stars, and I have two examples, but you'll have to help me with the first one. What was the name of the movie in which a young Richard Widmark, as a hoodlum, pushes an elderly woman in a wheelchair down the stairs? That vaulted him because he came across as a really tough killer with no conscience, and they really played it up. I also love Radio. He was on the Richard Widmark guest starred on the Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy show, and that role of him as that gangster and that scene of him... even though it was faked, of the woman going down the stairs. What was that movie?
That was, he was playing Tommy Udo in Kiss of Death, also a 1947 film.
What was your thinking of that film?
That's one we featured a couple years ago in the noir series over at the Dryden. That was a fantastic film, and I liked the sort of pairing of the two noir characters. You've got Victor Mature, who's coming out of jail, obviously having transgressed and become a criminal in his own right. But in comparison to Tommy Udo, the Richard Widmark character, it's this sliding scale of criminality or morality, where this criminal then becomes the hero of the film in that he's there to protect his own family.
Yeah, and I really like the premise of your question, because an actor like Richard Widmark was really built for the noir phenomenon. And in another great film that he does 2 years later, Night in the City, there was a unhinged quality to the young Richard Widmark that really a kind of unpredictable actor that just brought a little something extra to all of these noir roles.
And a lot of people remember some of his later roles where he used to play a really hard-bitten, cynical cop.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Like in Madigan.
Like in Madigan, exactly.
Well, and the film noir that I think sort of set up that persona for him was Pick Up on South Street, where he gets to be a pickpocket, but someone who is not as evil as in, you know, as unhinged as in these earlier roles, but somebody who is very cynical, very world-weary, but really sharp about the way he does it.
I guess in real life he was actually one of the nicest, warmest, most likable people in Hollywood, wasn't he?
He was at the George Eastman House just a few years ago getting the Honorary Scholar Award, and for all accounts he was a completely nice guy that got along with everyone.
And we usually don't think of Marilyn Monroe as film noir, but she came into her own in the film Niagara. She even got star billing above Joseph Cotten, and there she really played out of character insofar as her sweet, innocent roles, which she really was most likely in real life. It was real sad how Hollywood destroyed her. Like in another example, you might comment about Carol Landis, who committed suicide in 48 after she was jilted by Rex Harrison. But in Niagara, she really plays a really tough woman. The family name was Loomis, and Joseph Cotten, a returning veteran, goes out of his mind, and Marilyn dies at the end of the film, almost in a Hitchcockian way, insofar as the shot of her after she's fallen to her death. And I was wondering if you'd comment on Niagara.
Well, I think what's interesting about a film like Niagara is Marilyn Monroe actually appears in The Asphalt Jungle in 1950 in a bit part, where you really start to see another side of her persona, especially if you think about her in films like, you know, Gentlemen Always Prefer Blondes. She always liked a slightly more hard-boiled role. Mm-hmm. A film like Niagara is a brilliant film. It's called A Noir in Couleur, a color noir, done in the 1950s. You also have the great Hitchcock. You also have the great actor Joseph Cotten, worked a lot with Orson Welles and Alfred Hitchcock, doing a great performance in the film as well. And I think it is one of the classic 1950s noirs.
It's funny. I'm glad you mentioned this film for a couple of reasons. One, Monroe was fantastic, and I think this film is like Asphalt Jungle, where she had a very small part, but one that really sizzled and left an impression. This film shows her ability as an actress, I think. The final showdown, and I don't think it's actually a fall, if I'm remembering, and I don't want to give away what it is that does her in at the end, because it's a really dark and beautifully done scene in the sort of bell tower near the falls. But she had a depth as an actress that she was not often allowed to portray. And what starts to happen shortly after Niagara is that she really is given roles where she has to play a caricature of herself. And I think that's a shame, because she could have done so much more. And it's, I have no doubt, part of the reason that she became depressed and despondent and more difficult to work with and sort of led to a spiral. It's a great film, though. We were actually, we showed a brand new print of it at the TCM Classic Film Festival in Hollywood last year. And I was stunned by the beauty of this film. Her beauty as well, but the film was really, really well done.
And as I go here, could you comment on Carol Landis? I don't know if you would consider him her film noir, but her life and just the way it was lived, a film tragedy insofar as how her real life played out, Carol Landis?
Well, I don't have much to say on Carol Landis, but the history of noir actors frequently have some dark underbellies. Eddie Muller, in his book Dark City, does a great job tracing some of the tragic stories that happened, the most famous one being of Tom Neal, the star of the movie Detour, who really lived a noir nightmare in real life. And I think that that's, you know, just part of the dark underbelly of working in Hollywood. Sadly, some people's careers and lives are tragically cut short by that industry.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks very much for calling in, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Did it also, the whole genre, enable a lot of people who weren't the classic matinee idols to break through? I mean, you never would think of Edward G. Robinson as a matinee idol, or Jimmy Cagney or Humphrey Bogart. They broke the mold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really broke the mold.
We were just talking about Humphrey Bogart earlier today, looking at, I was giving Rich and Shannon a tour around some of the Eastman House vaults, and we pulled out some Maltese Falcon stills and Petrified Jungle. And just, we were talking about how this little squeaky guy that battled the lisp was able to become a leading man, largely because of film noir.
Right, and you didn't have to be what would probably by Hollywood standards be called a pretty boy in order to succeed in this type of film, which frequently is epicentered around the crime genre. And so I would agree with that premise that noir created a new type of star that I think, you know, especially nowadays, we're much more comfortable with. Something, a lead character, if you start to think about Humphrey Bogart and John Garfield and Edward G. Robinson, we're not talking Jimmy Stewart, Cary Grant, and John Wayne. So I would argue that noir starts to create the type of anti-hero character that does pull through to someone like Jack Nicholson in Chinatown, or, you know, type of William Hurt's performance in Body Heat, because there became a new opening in the Hollywood vocabulary for this type of tarnished, diminished hero.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Nicholson, of course, keeps playing this kind of ambiguous roles all the way at least to Preetzi's Honor, if not beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's beautiful in that picture,
yeah,
too.
And
the ultimate anti-hero is Bobster.
Right, yeah. And it's always fun to think about a film like Preetzi's Honor, where you have it being directed by the great John Huston, who directed The Maltese Falcon, and then really taking like today's talent and his daughter, Angelica Huston. And when I look at films like that, you really start to see how great Hollywood film history is when you get into understanding these cross-pollinations and these moments where, you know, the history of noir continues to develop in unexpected ways, so that even while Preetzi's Honor would be what I would more traditionally call a gangster film, there's noir elements of it, because how could it not be with people like Huston and Nicholson?
263-WXXI, Mike's on the line. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, listen, I got into this late. I hope this is somewhat relevant. I'm a big fan of Hemingway, and to have and have not, I've always wondered. I mean, you had Bacall, who I think probably moved all the way down to Kathleen Turner, if you ask me, in Body Heat, et cetera. But I'm just curious if that fits the noir example. And besides Bacall and Bogart, who was the actor that was shining in that as well. Do you remember?
Hoagy Carmichael was playing the piano.
Yeah, Hoagy Carmichael was on the piano. That's right. Was it?
That's it. Yeah.
Was Hoagy Carmichael you were thinking of? Okay.
Yeah, and then there's another detective. I think that plays one of the heavies. I don't know. I just find that movie, since I watched it the first time, I see pieces of that carrying on to the future, and I don't know, except to do
or not. Yeah, well, it's really fun. Tonight's film that we're screening at the Dryden Theater, Dead Reckoning, was actually the next film that Humphrey Bogart makes with another powerful leading lady, Elizabeth Scott, in the mold of To Have and Have Not. And one of the reasons why it's Elizabeth Scott in tonight's film and not Bacall is that Bacall was already optioned onto another film. And so if you saw tonight's film, Dead Reckoning, you would really see the same type of template for the kind of love interest that Bogey was having with his leading ladies in this film period. But the only thing I wanted to just mention to the caller was, if you like Hemingway and noir, the film that I would check out would be The Killers.
Yeah.
This film that's based on a short story by Hemingway. And while only the first 10 minutes of the film are the Hemingway short story, it is one of the truly great films noir of all time. So if you like Hemingway and noir, my pick to click is The Killers.
Aren't there a bunch of different renditions of that particular story?
Yeah.
So which one do you want?
46.
Of all the ones.
46.
The 46.
Yeah.
46.
And, you know,
okay. Thanks,
yeah, you betcha.
Yeah, because the 62 remake, which was originally a movie for television,
mm-hmm.
That you don't want.
That's
do
the Ronald Reagan and Angie Dickinson.
That's a Don right? Siegel yeah. film. I think yeah. that has a lot to speak for itself as well.
Yeah.
It does. It's a film role that Reagan regretted having taken because it was one of his last, if not his yeah. last film roles, and he plays a rather sadistic character, and he's sort of, yeah. he was
right
always sorry that was part of his legacy as an actor.
Well, it didn't keep him out of the White House.
Yeah.
No, it didn't.
If Bedtime for Bonzo wasn't going to keep him out of the White House, nothing.
Right. That wasn't.
and it did. So there you go. 263 WXXI. Georgiana's next on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm sort of a connoisseur of film noir. And I also remember when Dick Powell changed his image and made Murder My Sweet and Farewell My Lovely. And Elizabeth Scott was in one of those, I know. And always they had taste. Something we are rather unfamiliar with today, and the musical scores were excellent. Remember Laura?
Absolutely.
Yes, definitely. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for calling. You mentioned Dick Powell, and that kind of triggered something else. Later, Dick Powell did characters on television
mm-hmm.
that were sort of the rascally semi-noir type people. He created the character Dandy, which Howard Duff later did in a series on TV. I wonder if one of the biggest influences on television and television drama was film noir, and maybe it feeds TV more than anything else.
2 points there that I think really, you know, merit looking at a little more. One is this Dick Powell transformation, because he was a very capable actor, obviously, in terms of the number of transformations he went through to his image. For me, this has been one of our most lively debates over the years. What makes for a good noir protagonist? And we have debated to no end Murder, My Sweet, which is based yes. on Raymond Chandler's Farewell, My Lovely. They changed the title because Powell, up until this time, had been known really as a song and dance man. And they changed the title of the film to make sure that there was no confusion and that people wouldn't hear the original title, you know, Farewell, My Lovely, and think that it was Powell in another song and dance film. To my mind, that's the perfect proof that Powell never should have been cast as Marlowe in Murder, My Sweet. The fact they had to change the title to help recreate this persona as a tough guy is a great example of why he was not the best choice for Marlowe. To my mind, the Marlowe character is always going to be Humphrey Bogart, his portrayal from The Big Sleep. But this has been a point of contention with Rich and I. Rich loves that performance. The second part.
Yeah, because I think, just real quick, I think Powell has the right gravitas for the role. And even though he had earlier been in a certain type of genre, it didn't preclude him from being in this. And anyone who has seen Murder, My Sweet, it just has a great voiceover by Powell. And I love the way the film opens, because the film opens with him being blinded by a gunshot. And so you just get this really powerful image of a blind man narrating a dark tale.
Well, and this is exactly where we disagree, is I never liked the voiceover. This was our big point of contention when we talked about this film. I found it way too glib. And in any case, but the second part of the question was very interesting. This transformation from film noir to television. Absolutely. I think the answer is you couldn't have had Dragnet. You couldn't have had a lot of the police procedurals that followed without specific types of film noir. Really, the B films noir that set up the police procedural. I think of a film like He Walked by Night that is your template for Dragnet in many ways. And Jack Webb, who went on to star in Dragnet, was actually the lab scientist in the film He Walked by Night. And you can almost get the sense of him straining to be the tough leading guy in that film and wanting to be one of the police detectives. And instead, he's the white-coated lab guy. Guy who's, you know, looking at the ballistics.
I think we could probably do a whole other hour on TV noir. We were talking with Rich last night, who is a big proponent of Breaking Bad as one of the premier noir series or noir events mm-hmm. of the last half century.
Yeah.
But I would point also to series that are on basic cable, such as The Shield or Justified, which is on right now. A small series like Life. It was on for just two seasons with Damian Lewis, but all have these noir elements in them.
It's funny you mention those, because those are examples in each case of programs that were carried by guys who were terrific anti-heroes who started out in sitcoms
mm-hmm.
or
yeah.
in light or mm-hmm. in light dramedies. Michael Chiklis in The Commish,
yep.
and then Bryan Cranston in Malcolm in the Middle mm-hmm. as the inept
right.
dad.
Mm-hmm.
And look at what he is now.
Yeah. And what's so great is what I was talking about with Jared before this about shows like Breaking Bad and Justified that are on basic cable. You now have the return of a different type of censorship. It's not an HBO or a Showtime show. So they still are dealing with things that they can't overtly say. And censorship, again, helps enliven it. And if you watch those shows, if anyone likes these types of noir stories, I would just think that outside of some of these great films that have been coming out these last few years, these series, particularly Breaking Bad and Justified, are just in a class apart.
But there are only seven words they can't say now. And
right.
that's it. And that literally is true. And now the Supreme Court is looking at a case which may even wipe out that Heavy Seven list mm-hmm. and let them all out there.
Yeah.
That at least you can say it, if you can't
yeah.
show it.
No, I'd agree with that, but I still think that broadcasters are still a little more respectful of the overall audience demographic, so they do try to tone it down because younger kids particularly could see it. So yes, while there's less censorship, I would still argue noir style is always going to benefit to some degree to having limits or constraints mm-hmm. placed upon it.
Although you have a feeling that sooner or later that's going to fade too. I mean,
yeah.
we already have seen on television an episode of South Park where Mickey Mouse says all of the seven
yeah.
believable words, all of them,
yeah.
in one episode.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know how Disney felt about that.
as a side note, I was actually roommates with Matt Stone for a year at the University of Colorado, one of the two South Park creators. I haven't had any contact with him, so I'll never know what everything that motivated that, except, of course, they want to break down all those barriers. But, it's funny. I do think that this end of censorship is not helping us creatively. I think that artists who worked under the greatest constraints, whether those were financial or constraints of censorship, actually found more creative ways to do things. And ways, like our previous caller said, that weren't objectionable and that struck us as inventive. And the freer you are as an artist, I think in some strange ways, the less inventive you have to be.
There's one other thing that came to my mind, and I want to just throw it out for whatever it's worth today. It occurred to me, maybe film noir was one of the earliest places where women got to play more interesting and meaty roles.
Absolutely. And this is actually something that I wanted to talk about tonight in terms of tonight's film. You know, noir is all about mid-century anxieties. And what's so interesting is Hollywood's always been smart. They know that you either have to play on people's anxieties or you have to give them a way to completely escape their anxieties in order to have good box office. And in the mid-century, you've got a period when there are a lot of anxieties in American culture around women's roles. Men are off to war. The women are entering the workforce in massive numbers to keep the war machine, humming along. You've got a real rash of young war widows, and you have far more young women in this country than young men, especially in the workforce. And so it's a situation that was bound to create certain anxieties. And what happens is in film noir, which is all about anxieties and, social anxieties, women characters emerged who were far more nuanced. They had a far bigger arsenal of weapons at their disposal. They could be smart. They could be beautiful. The sizzle could get you. They were sometimes ruthless. They were dimensionalized in a way that women characters wouldn't be for another couple of decades.
Yeah, after Mary Fillmore. Astor fleshes that is. Yeah. Look at yeah. you. Absolute pathological liar. And, of course, at the end of the film, at the end of the Maltese Falcon, she's doing the perp walk.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right. So and then you also have another type of actress that gets into prominence in this period that I sometimes associate with an actress like Barbara Stanwyck in Double Indemnity, where the person who really wears the pants in Double Indemnity is Barbara Stanwyck, not Fred McMurray. And right. so the women are leading these men. And that's why we came up with this phrase, critically, calling a lot of these characters femme fatales or spider women, because there was the sense that these roles were expanding on really either the woman you want to marry or the motherly characters. Now you actually had a wider role for women, and I personally feel that it was a really good choice and actually has a lot of liberatory capacities in it.
And I mean, in the end, it reaches the logical conclusion with Thurman and her samurai sword.
Right.
And slicing and dicing everybody, and succeeded in the end in doing what she set out to do. And then after that, going off into the sunset with her little one.
Yep.
Right.
Aww.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole new sort of nuanced feminine role.
Right.
Sure, yeah, you can be a killer and a mom.
And you're right, Bob. That's the way to bring it full circle, because I think you again start to see how a director like Quentin Tarantino really is innovating and retelling the same stories, and each generation will be able to take these core myths and do them in a new style.
I want to figure out, I just read there's going to be a Kill Bill 3, and I'm trying to figure out
who's left to kill?
What the plot could possibly be. What can it be? Where does it go? Yeah.
Well, luckily it's Tarantino. He'll figure something out. And even if the plot is a little loose and fast, he'll figure out a way to make it look good.
It'll sure look interesting no matter what.
That's
I mean, that much we know for sure. Of course, the girl with the dragon tattoo, we know where that's going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are two more movies that have got to be made in order to complete the trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those will be interesting. Those will be good films as well. They'll be well acted and I'm sure well written, certainly well plotted. So that's something to look forward to.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Another ambiguous character, another ambiguous female character with a lot of strength and vulnerability and everything all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And David Fincher is one of our best living noir directors. I mean, I think a film like Seven's one of the best films of the 1990s. And, you know, this is a gentleman with films like Fight Club and, you know, films like Zodiac has always been in the noir vein. And so he was actually a good choice, although I actually have to admit I'm a fan of the European trilogy. I think that was also very well done. So if people want to see these films, they actually have already been recorded and filmed in Europe.
And the extended editions are now available, too, about 3 hours each. For each film. So it's about 9 hours of viewing.
Well, do you watch the English language version first and then look at the Scandinavian film, or do you go the other way?
It depends on your taste. I watched all these Scandinavian films first myself.
I'd read the books.
We could all do that. You can get them all right now. Yeah. And they haven't even made the last two films of the trilogy yet, but you can get all three books so you kind of know what's coming.
Yeah.
And with that, well, we know what's coming tonight at 8 at the Dryden Theater is Dead Reckoning with Humphrey Bogart, presented by our guests, Shannon Clute, Richard Edwards, Jared Case. And thanks for sharing film noir with us. We appreciate it, and thanks for letting us indulge a few of our guilty pleasures as movie watchers here. Thanks to the folks at the George Eastman House for helping us put it all together this hour at 1370 Connection from WXXI AM and FM HD2 Rochester. I'm Bob Smith. Stay with us. There's more to come after the news, and we'll see you then.